That's Don Patterson, a student of the Jimmy Smith School of Jazz Organ, opening up on his Hammond B3 with Goin' to Meetin'. Jerry Bird on guitar and Billy James on drums. It's from Patterson's 1965 album, Satisfaction. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Monday, April the 6th, and we'll be talking about the historic finish to a historic race. That's coming up in the second half of the program. But first, we get an update on the situation with Mumia Abu-Jamal. Keith Cook, his brother, is with us. He joins us now at a meeting that is soon to take place with the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. I want to thank you so much for being with us, Keith, today.
Thank you very much. I know Jimmy Smith.
You do?
I'm old enough to know.
That's good. He's one of my favorites. So tell us what's going on. Give us a little background. The first thing that we heard recently, of course, was that Mumia was discovered in a very deteriorated state of health, and was in fact that occurred as they were moving him to an ICU unit. Tell us about how it came to light that Mumia's health had deteriorated.
Well, you go have to go back to March the 30th. And, that is when Mumia blacked out, and he was taken to the Schuylkill Medical Center with the blood sugar at 777 or 779. One of those two numbers. It was close to 800, and we were told by doctors that we are consulting with that it changes with everyone, but when you get to be like 800, you're in coma territory. So at that time, they moved him down to that hospital there. His sodium level was also very high. It was higher than it. And I never knew that sodium could kill you also. I didn't know that. And he had like four guards around him. So they didn't tell us where he was. They didn't tell us where he was. And matter of fact, it was took us like 24 hours for them to acknowledge the fact that he was there. Even though we knew he was, we could, you know, we had went all the way up to the fourth floor to the ICM, ICU of the hospital there, and you could see the guards around this room. So we knew that that's not normal. So we said, well, this is where my mayor is. So we, you know, people in the hospital said, well, we can't talk to you. We can't tell you nothing. But, you know, every once in a while, somebody would say, you know, he's up there. And so, you know, the press wanted to know where he was. And when the press would call, they would say that we do not have Mumia Abu-Jamal in this hospital. And that was easy for them to say. And what we found out later is that they had Mumia in the hospital under Wesley Cook. So that's why when people were calling and the press was calling, nobody could find him. Somebody had to be around for a long time to understand or to ask, is there Wesley Cook there? But I think Mumia changed his name probably when he was age 15, and he'll be 62 in his next birthday. And he also has, you know, they also reported that he had kidney stones. So there's a whole lot of things that is wrong with Mumia's body. But Mumia has been sick for approximately 3 months. That's how we got to this point. He's been sick, and they put him in in the subway at the prison for 2 weeks dealing with his skin disease that he had come up with. And for lack of another name, and nobody has ever given it another name,
eczema.
Yes, yes.
Eczema. Now, you were able to see him, but only for half an hour. His wife was only able to see him also for half an hour. What did he tell you in that short visit?
Yes, that day they finally did allow two visits. You know, we had fought about that for a whole day. And we came out and they said that two people can see him, two family members can see him for 30 minutes each. And so when I went in, he was having lunch. And I helped him cut up his meat, and we talked, and it's obviously that he was very, very weak, but he was doing what he could do. And he was handcuffed to the, one arm was handcuffed to the chair, because he was sitting up in a chair. He was sitting up in a chair with a pillow behind to give his neck and head some support.
Has the family been able to get its own medical person, its own doctor,
no,
to evaluate him and therefore compare what they find as opposed to what the state is saying is wrong with Mumia?
No, we're in the process now of demanding that from the state. And also shooting something to the courts, also trying to go to the federal courts about Mamiya's health. So the state of Pennsylvania in the prison system, as I understand it, only has one trained dietitian, and that person only comes around by appointment. But they have not. One of our demands is that they allow us to have our own doctor in there and for him to get a full examination so we can get to the bottom of all these things that have been building up seemingly no help from the prison system.
You're about to have a showdown of sorts in terms of a meeting with the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. What are you going to be raising in that meeting, and what do you expect the attitude of the department to be when you meet with it?
Well, we do not expect the meeting to be pleasant for either side, because, you know, the prison has done this for years, not giving the family any account about what's wrong with their sons or daughters. No account. They have no responsibility to do that. And so this push that we're putting them on them now is bigger than any push they've had put on them previously. Matter of fact, they told me at one time that we were lucky that we're getting to see him, because they never let anyone see a prisoner when he's sick, unless he's dying. So seems as though the law is a bad law that they've been using for the policy, that when somebody is very sick, that someone in that person's family cannot visit them. It seems as though when somebody wakes up from operation, from deep sleep or coma, whatever, the person they want to see there is a family member, not four guards standing around him. So there's something wrong with that law. And it's time for the law to be challenged. You know, parents and family should not lose all their rights about seeing their sons and daughters and husbands just because they're incarcerated. They should not lose all their rights to those individuals. So we are asking for examinations and treatment right now. We want to have someone who can look at what he has and examine him. You know, both the prison and the hospital, neither one have someone on staff that could deal with diabetes. There was not a diabetes doctor on the staff at that Schuylkill Medical Center. So no one checked him for that at all through the 3 days that he was there prior to that and in at going back to the prison. No one with those kind of credentials have seen Mamir and examined him.
There is a concern, a particular concern about Mumia's welfare, because in this regard, your family has a prior experience losing a brother, I understand. Could you talk about why it is important to remain on top of this? Because, of course, Mumia, having fallen into a near comatose state, by that time, it was clear that this condition had been he had been prevailing for a long time and went undiagnosed and therefore untreated. Could you talk about the prior experience that you had with a family member?
Yeah, I had a family member. Matter of fact, one of my younger brothers, Ronald, who passed away in prison. No word until 3 or 4 days later, and they wanted to know if I was going to. I mean, I guess I fell out of my chair, wanted to know if I wanted to have the body or that did I want to cremate it. And I'm saying, who are you talking about? Well, you know, Ronald Cook passed away 4 days ago. You know, very shocking the way they handle that. And to bring something even closer, and this is something that probably some of your listeners can remember, is that Phil Africa, who was in prison 2 months ago, died at the hospital. And for 5 days, you know, we were able to, because we were organizing and had a lot of people and was able to get on the phones and everything, we were able to find the mayor in a matter of hours. But when it came to Mr. Africa, a prisoner called the family to tell them that he's been shipped to a hospital. So when the family got on it to talk, to find out where he was or what was wrong with him, nobody told him anything for 5 days. And then in 5 days, they allowed two people. They told him what was wrong and two people to go see him. And the next day, Phil Africa died. So they didn't let the family know where he was or what was wrong with him for 5 days. And then that most of the people know, because there, you know, a lot of our supporters and friends are from the Move Africa. You know, that's paramount on their mind. And for us to read the newspapers and know things, it's paramount on ours also, that the state has no responsibility to you at all if you have a family member that's incarcerated, that if they get sick, they have no responsibility of telling you anything unless they feel as though that person is getting ready to die. So when they told Phil Africa's family after 5 days, they knew that the man was about to die. And the day after they visited him, he did in fact terminate. So that's a law that needs to be worked on. And hopefully, regardless of how people feel about prisoners, we should all feel as though that's unfair. And that there needs to be more compassion in our laws for prisoners and their families, because there's all types of reasons why people are in prison. You know, we continue to say and to know that Mamir is innocent and never should be in this place in the first place. But you know, the story is that he's been there for 34 years now, 29, 30 years on death row. So, you know, there's people in prison for all kinds of things. You know, people in prison for smoking marijuana during 40 years and they get sick or whatever the case may be. You know, so we understand now more about it. We understand that when someone goes to prison, we understand that the numbers is that in 90 days, 30% of those who just went in have diabetes. And from all this food, you know, one of the things that when we saw Mamir on Friday, he had just finished eating some spaghetti. Now, we know that he's not supposed to eat that. You know, that kind of food turns to sugar the quickest. They know that. But what happens is he's still not on a diet because there's not a dietitian there to put him on a diet. So he's eating what they sent him. You know, we've kind of hit him on Friday about, you know, some of these things that you may lack them, but you can't mess with them no more. But he doesn't have anything on the paper or the dining facility. He doesn't have mamie and say if he can only have these kind of meals. We're not there yet. He has not been examined or put on a proper diet to survive. So with all these things going on.
Well, I know you're going to go into this meeting today. Good luck with it. Okay. We will be following up so that we keep tabs on what's happening to Mumia and his health. But thank you so much for being with us today to give us this update. I know you're under the crunch of time, and all the more reason for thanking you for taking the time to talk with us today, Keith Cook. Thank you.
Okay. I appreciate you covering this. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Just so you know, Mumia Abu-Jamal was convicted and sentenced to death in July 1982 for the killing of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner in 1981. His trial was rife with prosecutorial and judicial irregularities, and Mumia's case became an international cause for justice. In 2011, the Third Circuit Court vacated his death sentence and instead imposed life without parole. He is still fighting that judgment, but he was removed from death row in 2012 after more than 30 years. So we'll continue to monitor what's happening with Mumia Abu-Jamal. We'll take this break and then go to Chicago right after this. Even as Rahm Emanuel and his challenger, Cook County Commissioner Jesus Chuy Garcia, make last-ditch forays for votes, they're homing in on two key blocks that will determine who next occupies City Hall: undecided voters and African-American and Latino voters. A weekend poll by Ogden and Fry was showing Emanuel with an appreciable lead over Garcia going into Tuesday. But the poll also showed large numbers of uncommitted voters and noted that Latinos were underrepresented in its own data. Local media also reporting a double-digit lead on by Emanuel, nonetheless are hesitant to call the race because of Garcia's stunning upset the first go-around on February the 24th that forced the runoff. Lead Stories listener Gardas H. Watts, a native Chicagoan who has been following the contentious race, is here with us today as our correspondent. He's going to be providing perspective on the significance of the Emanuel Garcia face-off and how it's resonating at ground level in his hometown. And welcome as commentator today and a correspondent.
Hey, how you doing, Utrice?
Fine, thank you. So it's the eve of the historic election in Chicago, the first time an incumbent mayor has been forced into a runoff since the city adopted nonpartisan elections 20 years ago. And I understand the Windy City is bristling with anticipation about the outcome. Tell us about what's happening in Chicago.
Yes, as you stated, that this is the first time a runoff has happened since the nonpartisan system was implemented in the Chicago mayoral election. It was very surprising how Rahm Emanuel, was the incumbent mayor, only got 45% of the vote in the February 24th election, and how Chewy came out second with 33. But also, too, the turnout for the February 24th election was just about 33%. That's a little over a million registered voters who didn't vote that day. So it was a very low turnout. It was probably one of the lowest turnouts since 2007 that they recall. With Chicago, Chicago is basically a very kind of fickle type of city where they'd like to see change, but they just want to see change, you know, appear out of the air. When they see candidates that they feel are not viable, then, you know, generally most of Chicago just doesn't go out and vote. And that's why, you know, with the 33% voter turnout, you also see, too, the unhappiness of Chicago voters with Rahm Emanuel. I think a lot of Chicagoans are starting to see what he's done in the last 4 years hasn't been enough for them to go out to vote for him. And with Chewy, I think the thing is that Chewy was kind of relatively a surprise since Karen Lewis last year was looking to get into the race, but due to health concerns, she backed out, and she asked Chewy to step in for her. And
Karen Lewis being the president of the Chicago Teachers Union.
Yes, Karen Lewis being president of the Chicago Teachers Union. So he stepped in for her. But I wanted to kind of like, you know, just for the national audience, kind of run down like the quick political history of each of these candidates. Obviously, Chewy got his start in politics in 1984, where he won an aldermanic seat in the 22nd Ward with the backing of Harold Washington. He was also able to win the 1986 special aldermanic election when Harold Washington got the backing of the U.S. Appellate Court to remap the wards from 1980 because he argued that the wards were unfairly drawn and disenfranchised black and Latino voters. So once Chewy won his seat again, the Harold Washington administration was able to get a foothold within the Latino community, along with Chewy, Juan Vasquez, Luis Gutierrez, who was a congressman now, Miguel Collazo, and a bunch of other Latino politicians as well. So Harold was able to form a coalition with the Latino community along with Chewy. Chewy served as alderman up until 1982, where he ran for Illinois State Senator for the 1st District and actually became the first Illinois State Senator of Mexican descent. He served as senator until 1998, when he lost his reelection bid to Antonio Munoz, who was supported by the Daily, or as a lot of people say, call it the Daily Machine. Chewy stepped out of the electoral politics scene for a couple of years when he served as the executive director of the Little Village Community Development Corporation, which is a nonprofit organization that helps the Little Village community. It's the community Chewy is from. Little Village is a neighborhood in Chicago, Chicago's near West Side, which is predominantly Mexican. Chewy got back into politics in 2010 when he ran for a seat for the Cook County Commissioner of the 7th District, and he eventually won that seat. And like we were saying last year, he was approached by Karen Lewis to run for the race for mayor, and he accepted. Chewy's endorsements, obviously we know that Chewy is being endorsed by the Chicago Teachers Union, but he also has an endorsement from the Service Employee International Union, SEIU, from the local healthcare division here in Illinois, and also the local number one division, which represents unionized janitors here in Illinois. Among his other supporters, he also has support from Rainbow Push President Jesse Jackson. He also has support from Willie Wilson, a black Chicago businessman who ran for mayor last in February and surprisingly got 11% of the votes. Denny Davis is also a supporter, who is a U.S. House rep. And also, Chewy has in the past recent weeks got endorsements from Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and Governor Howard Dean. His local media endorsements are the Chicago Gazette, and weirdly enough, the Chicago Jewish Star has supported Chuy Garcia. Kind of weird, considering Rahm Emanuel being of Jewish descent, they didn't support him. Now we go to kind of like a brief political history of Rahm. I think most people know about Rahm's time in Washington as chief of staff for Obama, but a lot of his political roots basically started back in the 1984 when he helped Paul Simon run for the U.S. Senate seat and actually won. He also was a chief fundraiser for Richard Daley when they did a special election in 1989 after the death of Harold Washington. He helped Daley win his mayor's seat and afterwards went to go join Bill Clinton in his presidency for U.S. president. Rahm actually came back into the local political scene here in Chicago in 2002 when he ran for a U.S. House seat for the 5th District. It's actually his first elected position in politics. And ironically, during that election, he was actually endorsed by the Chicago Teachers Union. So that's kind of weird. But Rahm would serve as congressman until 2008 when he went to be chief of staff for Obama. And then afterwards, when Daley shocked Chicago in 2010, saying that he wasn't going to run for the mayoral election in 2011, Rahm immediately put his name in. And with the backing of Obama and millions of dollars of campaign funds, Rahm easily won the election in 2011, garnering about 55% of the votes. So Rahm actually has a couple of unions as well, more corporate unions, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and United Here, a union that represents hotel and hospitality workers. Rahm has endorsements from Bob Fioretti, who was a mayoral candidate in last month's election that only mustered about 7% of the votes. Obviously, he has President Obama's endorsement. His major media, his endorsements from major media outlets include the Sun-Times, Tribune, Chicago Crane's Business, and even longtime black-owned newspaper, the Chicago Defender. So right now, it's basically like you said, with Ogden and Fry's survey coming out. It's interesting. On Friday, they did a repolling and actually took out the option of undecided, and Rahm significantly got higher numbers. I think he got 56% compared to 43%. So it looks like going from mainstream media and from these different particular polling places that Rahm is going to win tomorrow's election. However, as we know, we didn't think that it would go this far. The early voting is over right now, but apparently the early voting got up to about 142,000 participants. That's over 900,000 more than what the early voting cast was in the February 24th election. So it's going to be an interesting race. And just like with most mayoral elections that's this close, it's basically divided along racial lines. Majority of white Chicago is voting for Rahm. Majority of Latino Chicago is voting for Chuy. And the swing vote here is the African American community here in Chicago. So it's practically undecided right now, with a lot of people kind of tending to shift towards Rahm just a little bit. But there's still a lot of undecided African American voters here in Chicago.
Gardis, you gave us a pretty good context so far. How about telling us, how is each of the candidates situating himself with respect to the message that they're conveying in their campaign? And how is it basically appealing, if it is, to their political bases?
Well, if you look at the messages that they have been going forth a lot of their campaign points have been obviously economics, how they're going to decrease the deficit of Chicago city budget. Schools has been a talking point. The education system has been a talking point as well, and also in regards to the violence here in Chicago, which has been basically the three major points, campaign points. In regards to education, Chewy basically promised the voters that they'll go back to an elected school board. Rahm has basically taken his stance of how he quote unquote improved the Chicago public school systems by, you know, giving the schools an all day kindergarten, and in regards to trying to close the gap. I think he said he closed the CPS budget gap to like $200 million. I can't remember the numbers, but that's his campaign points of that. In regards to the violence in Chicago, generally Chewy promised to put about 10,000 more police officers in the neighborhood communities, along with trying to get more detectives on the scene. Rahm has basically kind of promised just about the same thing. So they're kind of close on those two issues. Now, in regards to the economics of Chicago and the big budget deficit that Chicago is facing, Chewy basically, a lot of people in the Rahm Emanuel campaign is kind of blasting Chewy for the first couple of weeks after the election, because apparently Chewy has not revealed what he would exactly do to decrease the budget deficit in City Hall, whereas Rahm has basically said that he was going to apply quote unquote luxury taxes to the city in regards to big name purchasing items, in regards to club membership, that type of thing. But generally, it's honestly to me, I think it's kind of like political, spinning when it comes to that. But I will say this: Chewy did candidly basically say that, you know, the reason why he didn't give out his budget plan because he really doesn't know, and he wants to go in and open the books and do some auditing to see what he can do to shorten the shortfall of the economic deficit in Chicago.
Well, you pointed out that the African American community is really the swing vote here, along with the undecideds. To that end, what is the leadership's role at this point in the campaign? And is it a matter, are they too little too late, or are they really pulling for their candidate?
Well, the problem with the African American leadership in Chicago is they're all divided. A lot of division amongst the African American leadership in regards to the political people, the ministers, business owners. They're all divided amongst who they want to support. You have a group of ministers who are supporting Rahm. You have a group of ministers who are supporting Chewy. Same with the politicians and same with the businessmen. So it's very much split in terms of leadership. So the problem is with the leadership, there is typically not much leadership to guide the African-American voters in Chicago, which seems to me is the reason why, African-Americans here are kind of split on, voting for either Rahm or Chewy. If anybody who lived in Chicago who is black for the last 4 years understand what Rahm is doing, probably already knows that Rahm is not the person you want as mayor for the next 4 years in Chicago. However, there's not enough support for Chewy because of the fact that he's well, first of all, he's relatively unknown. And also, too, there has been a divide between the Latino and the African American community here in Chicago. And that divide has happened ever since the death of Harold Washington. Latinos and blacks here have become more and more split on a lot of things. And we have a crazy understanding in some parts of the African American community that if you vote for Chewy, then, you know, basically Chewy's going to make Chicago an all Mexican type of city, which is to me absolutely ridiculous. I mean, this complex of the fear of a brown city resonating amongst African Americans is actually totally ridiculous to me. But the leadership here, because of the fact that they have failed to unite on a same front, and even majority of the leadership has failed, you know, the black community to guide them on where they need to go in regards to supporting, you know, one candidate or the other.
So right now, how are you reading this election? What is likely to be the attitude of voters tomorrow? Is it expected that it would be brisk voting? Is there excitement about this race? Is this race actually being seen as the historic race that people are saying it is going to be, whichever way it turns out?
Well, I think there's an air of anticipation here because of the fact that it's a big unknown, despite the fact that we see these polls and we see these reports about Rahm winning. The air of anticipation is generally kind of, I would say, how should I put it? Kind of like trying to understand what's next in regards to Chicago, because I don't feel there's a lot of excitement in regards to this election, with the exception of really astute political people. And not even astute political people, but people who just kind of care about their communities. Because of the fact that Chicago, for the last 20 years, have been kind of, you know, ransacked by Daley, and in some way, shape, or form, ransacked by Rahm. It's sort of like Chicago is kind of given up because of the fact that they felt like the political machine is kind of just too big. Now, we don't know what the outcome will be tomorrow. Maybe Chicago might wake up tomorrow and decide to go out and hopefully, you know, make a change and make some sort of decision on how to take back the politics of Chicago back to the hands of the people in Chicago. So the atmosphere right now is still very uncertain, not exciting, but just kind of like fear of the unknown type of thing. That's the atmosphere I'm kind of getting.
Well, the most popular person who played a role in this race was the person who came out of Chicago, who is now president of the United States. Has Barack Obama's influence here as an endorser of Rahm Emanuel, has that contributed to the state of flux of the black voters in Chicago?
Yeah, actually, even staunch Barack Obama supporters are not fully endorsing Rahm Emanuel, and it actually is surprising because obviously with Obama supporters, anything he touches turns to gold. So I was actually shocked how I talked to some Obama supporters and how they were highly disappointed with Rahm Emanuel. So you are starting to see the Obama factor not being a factor here in this race, which was a big thing in 2011 when he first ran for mayor, because Obama still being kind of fresh in office was the huge factor of Rahm winning the first time, but you don't see that factor being being that much of a difference here in this particular race, and probably one of the reasons why there is a runoff right now.
On the one side, we have Rahm Emanuel with solid, or I should say more solid, corporate backing, big money backing. Are we seeing, on the other side, with Chewy, are we seeing a resurgence here of coalition politics, of grassroots politics, or is it just being over-exaggerated at this point?
No, you're definitely seeing a resurgence of grassroots politics. Obviously, anybody here knows, and even on the national level, that Rahm Emanuel definitely outspends Chewy Garcia. I mean, Rahm Emanuel has millions of dollars in his campaign coffer, so it's sort of like he has an unlimited slush fund to spend whatever he wants to on this campaign, whereas Chewy just barely got over $1 million or so. So it's sort of like, you know, in regards to finances, it is generally the big guy versus the little guy. But I think tomorrow we will get our answer if grassroots politics still works. Because even if Chewy loses this race, if the numbers are close, I feel that the grassroots politics still works, and maybe in the next mayoral election it would overtake corporate backed elections in the future. So tomorrow we'll see, but right now it looks like it is working to a point, because of the fact that just for the simple fact that we have a runoff shines the light that grassroots politics still might be alive in Chicago.
What is it that you think that the Chewy Garcia, what is his strength as an insurgent, as a challenger to Rahm Emanuel and the Democratic machine in Chicago? What do you think he brings to the table that is particularly noteworthy?
Well, Chewy basically, one of his strengths is his alliance with labor. One of the things that's tied to the economic issues in Chicago is the unemployment rate. Labor in Chicago is very much heavily in favor of Chewy. Most people who are supporting Chewy is hoping that he can bring down the unemployment rate within Chicago, and in particular, one of the sticking points, especially within the African American community, is the unemployment rate within the African American community. I mean, the last numbers that was calculated, 20%. There's a 20% unemployment rate within the Black community. So the thing is that with his ties to civil labor unions in regards to the Chicago Teachers Union and the SEIU, they're hoping that he can bring jobs to Chicago without kind of selling out Chicago to corporations, because that's what a lot of neoliberal Democrats want. They kind of like sell out their cities just to bring jobs, and these jobs basically pay you, less than $10 a day. So Chewy's backing seems like it's more hopefully bringing back labor back to Chicago and fair wages in regards to that. So his ties to the labor unions makes a big difference to those who are supporting him.
And what do you think Rahm Emanuel's greatest strength is as the incumbent candidate?
Well, obviously his greatest strength is resources and money. Rahm Emanuel has this heavy influence in regards to the backing of corporations. He could basically come in and easily bring in a lot of jobs with his ties to the banking industry. So Rahm generally has that type of He has connections. That's the basic point of Ron's strength, is his connection to a lot of things. And it's not as bad as I may think it is, because if you look at political history, Mayor Jay Daley, the mayor of Chicago, who was mayor from like the 50s to the 70s, he had that same particular type of connections with Chicago. And as corrupt as he was, Chicago never ran out of money. He always made sure Chicago kept running, even though his connections were a little shady. That's how I kind of see Rahm Emanuel's strength as possibly, you know, mayor of Chicago.
In your estimation, based on Rahm Emanuel's first term, what do you think of the possibility of a second term? What is the city likely to experience under Rahm Emanuel for a second term?
Well, in my estimation, going back to his first 4 years, I see a lot of disenfranchisement with black and brown people within the city of Chicago. I see a lot of poor blacks and a lot of poor Latinos being priced out of Chicago because of the high property tax rates, just the high property rates in general in a lot of communities. A lot of the gentrification going on in a lot of neighborhoods within the south side of Chicago, which is heavily African American, and also too with neighborhood schools being the issue, because there is on the horizon an option to close more schools, more neighborhood schools, majority within the African American and even Latino communities as well. So the thing is that I see the black and brown population, especially poor black and brown populations, being significantly decreased at the end of a second term of Rahm Emanuel.
Ouch. That's not good news. Well, I want to thank you for your first foray as a correspondent for Lead Stories. You call in all the time, and you seem to have a handle on things in your hometown. And it was great that you were able to offer this perspective to us today, to give us a sense of what's at stake and how it is kind of shaping up people's attitudes about tomorrow's election. So, of course, we'll be taking a look at the results of the election, and I have my own thoughts about that. I'm looking at particular aspects of it as well to see how they unfold. But I want to thank you so much, Gardas, for being with us today and for braving the elements in terms of offering yourself as our local correspondent in Chicago. Thank you so much. So how do you think you did today?
I guess I did okay. I didn't even say half of what I wanted to say.
Well, you'll get to it, because of course this is just a little primer, and there'll be a lot of discussion. This is a very, very important race, and for a number of reasons, which we will explore, but this is a very, very important race for people to pay attention to, because the ramifications will be reverberating beyond the borders of Chicago. And in a way, this is a template for what will happen in other major cities as well.
Well, you, Sharice, can I say one more thing?
Sure.
The thing is that I wanted to clarify why that's important, because you bring up a good topic, because of the fact that when you talk about Chicago's deficit, the biggest deficit within the Chicago deficit is the pension debt that they're having. And mm-hmm. What happened in Detroit, same thing. They had a pension deficit they couldn't recover from. So this is very important, because of the fact that the pension deficit in Chicago is one of the key elements and the connecting elements to a city like Detroit that was going through the same thing a couple of years ago. So that is why this race is very important.
Thanks once again for offering your services so willingly, Gardas. I really enjoyed your time with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And that brings us to the end of our program today. I hope that we had some things to think about. It gives us an idea that sometimes, you know, things are happening outside of your geographic confines, and you think, well, that's in Chicago, but really it's you. Because what's going to happen in Chicago on Tuesday will also be happening in New York very soon, and in Philadelphia, and in Baltimore, and Washington, D.C. We talked about Detroit being a template for this new wave of not just the business of how government perceives its role, but what they actually are doing in these major cities, which also just so happen to have large populations of Black and Brown people. And these are the cities that will experience incredible transformations, and in fact, it's already ongoing. It has already begun. So we look at Chicago because it has great implications for what will happen in these other parts of the country. So we pay attention to that. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. You will want to reach me, I hope, at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with you, Therese Lead. I just want to thank you so much for joining me today. As always, a pleasure and a great, great privilege to be in your company. Thank you, and we'll talk again tomorrow. Bye-bye.